this time, I'd like to inform all parties today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Thank you.
Okay, so good morning, everyone, again. This is the Tron Telecon for October 28, 2014. And this morning, or afternoon, depending upon where you are, we are pleased to bring you Dr. Phil Nicholson. He is a professor of astronomy at Cornell University in their Department of Astronomy. Dr. Nicholson received his PhD at Caltech and is currently a Cassini-VIMS team member. VIMS is the Visual and Infrared Mapping Spectrometer. He's also the Rings Target Working Team, one of the Rings Target Working Team co-chairs. So you can see he's pretty deeply versed in the goings-on around Cassini. In his career, he has studied the rings of Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. He's used ground-based, Earth-based spacecraft data to do this. And doesn't just do rings. He's been involved in the discovery of small moons at pretty much all the giant planets, from moons at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. He's even led a team studying the Shoemaker-Levy 9 impacts. Phil, I believe you're also interested in atmospheres. I know that I've seen you make requests for atmospheric occultations in our timelines on Cassini. He is currently the editor of Icarus, and that's really just a sampling of all the research and scientific activities with which Dr. Nicholson is involved. There's a lot to him, and today we are pleased to have him come talk to us about chronoseismology. I have heard a little bit about this. I think it's really fascinating to think that we can actually learn something about the interior of Saturn just by studying its rings. So, Phil, if you are ready, please take it away. Just remember that since everyone is following along on their own, you'll need to sort of let people know when you advance your slides. And everyone also should know that Star 6 will mute your phone. So with no further ado, I give you Dr. Nicholson.
Okay. Thanks, Sean. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Hopefully everyone else can too.
Give me a yell if I get too faint. I'm using a speakerphone here, but I'm pretty close to it.
Okay. Sometimes I do have a little hard time hearing you on telecons, but right now you're coming in great. So.
Okay. I'm sitting right in front of the phone. So. Okay. So as good morning or afternoon, everyone. And Sean already told you what this is about, and the data we're going to be looking at here come from actually stellar occultation observations of the rings. I'll tell you a bit more about that in a moment. But as the title and Sean's outline suggested, the scientific goal here is to actually learn something about the interior structure of the planet, which is not something we initially expected that we would be able to do by studying the rings. So it is kind of surprising. So if we go on to the second slide, one with the pictures of Jupiter and Saturn and the Juno and Cassini spacecraft. This is just to remind us that at the same time that Cassini is wrapping up its mission at Saturn over the next 3 years, and it will be wrapping it up by flying through some orbits that are indicated in this picture here. First, the blue orbits that will cross the ring plane just outside of the main rings. This picture is a little bit misleading, but we won't actually go through the main rings, but we'll cross just outside. And then we'll have a final set of orbits that are being called the proximal orbits, which are shown in yellowish-orange here, where we actually fly between the innermost rings and the planet. And one of the main purposes, not the only purpose, but a major purpose of these orbits is to measure the planet's gravity field in exquisite detail by Doppler tracking the spacecraft as it flies literally just above the cloud top of the planet. And we can measure the mass of the planet and its low-order gravity field components by tracking the Cassini spacecraft during its normal mission, and we've been doing that for the last 10 years. But to measure the what gravity people refer to as the high-order harmonics in the gravity field, or equivalently just the high-resolution structure in the gravity field, you need to get close into the planet, and basically you need to be as close to the planet as the scale of the gravity signatures you're wanting to find out. So Cassini will do that in 2017 and tell us much more than we currently know about the gravity field, and that's an important bit of information on the interior. Coincidentally, at about the same time, the Juno spacecraft will go into orbit around Jupiter and will do a dedicated program of orbits, which are actually very similar to what Cassini will do in its proximal orbit. So Juno will be obtaining similar gravity data for Jupiter at fortuitously pretty much the same time Cassini is doing it for Saturn. So that's what geophysicists or scientists in general have been looking forward to as the best new information that will come along that to tell us about the interior structures of these planets. But there is another way of learning about structures, and if we go to the third slide, which is a bit of a primer on some seismology, another way that we can learn about planets, which has been exploited most for the Earth, but as I hope I'll convince you, can be done for the outer planets as well, and that is to do seismic studies. On the Earth, that means exploiting seismic waves that propagate through the Earth that originate at earthquakes. So this little cartoon in the lower left shows a rough cross-section of the Earth showing the upper and lower mantle and the outer and the inner core. And then it shows an earthquake up at about 10:30 o'clock. And then a series of curved lines that indicate the waves, the paths that waves travel as they move out from the earthquake. And in this, since the Earth is solid, there are two kinds of waves, P waves, which are basically compressional or sound waves, and S waves, which are basically shear waves. And you can see that those waves don't travel in straight line. They travel in curves, and that's because the velocity of seismic waves increases the deeper you go into the Earth. As the pressure goes up and the rocks get squeezed, the rate at which they transmit waves goes higher. So the concave upwards curvature is characteristic of that velocity increasing. But you see the Earth has boundaries within it, in particular a boundary between the mantle, lower mantle, and the outer core where the velocity decreases, and the paths show a definite kink at that point. And it was observing the effect of that kink on the timing of seismic waves that led seismologists back in the 1920s and 30s to conclude that, in fact, the Earth did have an inner core, and later on they concluded that this was a core probably made of liquid iron. So we can't quite do seismology on the outer planets because we don't have a solid surface with continents grinding around creating earthquakes. And while we don't have solids to transmit the waves, nevertheless, the fluid material inside Jupiter and Saturn, the gas slash liquid, happily will transmit sound waves. So the equivalent of P waves in the Earth do propagate within the giant planets. The trouble is we don't have anything equivalent to earthquakes to trigger them, and we can't put a seismometer on the surface of Jupiter or Saturn to measure them, so you might say this is hopeless. But there is a different, slightly different permutation on seismology, which is not looking at waves traveling from discrete earthquakes, but the whole planet ringing rather like a bell. So you imagine that if you hit a bell, any particular bell has its own natural frequency that it will oscillate at, and if you hit it the right way, it will usually oscillate in various overtone frequencies as well as the basic frequency. And those oscillations of a bell you can think of as a whole bunch of seismic waves bouncing around and reflecting off the inside of the bell. And only the ones that will bounce in a way across the planet in a way to reinforce themselves will wind up generating the pure frequency or the natural frequency that we associate with the bell. So a spherical planet has a whole bunch of different modes that it can oscillate at. The fundamental ones, the equivalent of the fundamental frequency of a bell, have periods of about an hour for a planet like the Earth, and a little bit longer, about 2 hours, for planets like Jupiter and Saturn. It's determined mostly by the mean density inside the planet. And the little yellow cartoon at the lower right shows sort of schematically what one of these modes of oscillation could look like. If you could look at Saturn and if it were ringing in this fashion, and you could measure what parts of the surface were moving outwards, and if you were to color those in as blue, at the same time look at the parts of the surface that are moving inwards and color those in as red, you would see this pattern of alternating blue and red squares. And that corresponds to just one of the many dozens of different modes that the planet could ring with or oscillate with. And each one of those will have a slightly different frequency of oscillation. Generally, as you get a more and more complicated pattern, With more and more blue and red squares, the frequency will go higher. But as I said, the lowest modes, the ones in which you just have a couple of blue and red squares on the planet, the periods are a couple of hours. So we don't know what would excite such oscillations in the planets, but we know by looking at the Sun that the Sun is continuously ringing in many millions, actually, of these individual oscillation modes. And the subject of studying those is called helioseismology, and it's been practiced by helioseismologists for the last 25 years or so, and they've now learned a lot about the interior of the Sun by looking at these. That subject, on the other hand, is in its infancy when it comes to the giant planets, and until now, nobody had convincingly even detected the presence of any of these modes. But I'm going to try to convince you that by looking in Saturn's rings, we're actually seeing signatures due to exactly this kind of oscillation inside Saturn. Attempts have been made to do this with Jupiter as well, with sort of mixed success. Jupiter doesn't have a nice ring system like Saturn's to detect the modes, but people have looked at the brightness of Jupiter and they've measured the Doppler shift of its surface and tried to detect the presence of these modes, but the results, I think, remain controversial. It's not clear whether they've really been seen or not. So that's enough for background. So let's go on and look at the rings in slide 4 and start to come to grips with how we would detect these oscillations inside the planet. But maybe this is a good spot to stop for a second, and if I've already said something hopelessly confusing, if anybody has a quick question, now would be a good time to ask. Okay, I don't hear anything, so I'll go on. Are we still on, Sean? Everything okay?
Yeah, we are. I think you're doing a great job of explaining everything, which perhaps explains a few questions.
Well, people are already bewildered, perhaps, but anyway, we'll see. So slide number 4, at the top you see just a beautiful Voyager, beautiful Cassini image. The comment is about Voyager, but this particular picture is from Cassini. So this is an image that shows the entire extent of the main ring system of Saturn. The outermost part is called the A ring. The middle and the brightest part, where we think most of the mass is called the B ring. And then the inner and faintest part is called the C-ring, and the C-ring actually is the part we'll be concentrating on here. Now, people are familiar with studying the rings by taking images of them. They're a little bit less familiar with the technique of using occultations to study the rings. So the middle panel shows just a little snippet of an occultation profile across the rings, and it just shows the part that's the middle C-ring, basically indicated by the blue lines. And what you're looking at here, it's labeled optical depth, and it's plotted against radius, and that's measured in thousands of kilometers. So you're seeing a range of from 80 to 88,000 kilometers, or about 8,000 kilometers, a bit more than the radius of the Earth this region covers. And what we do is watch a star move behind the rings, and the star moves behind really because Cassini is moving in its orbit around Saturn. So the star appears to move behind the rings. And as it moves from moment to moment, we use the VIMS instrument in this case to measure the brightness of the star. And we do that about every 20 to 40 milliseconds of time. So we do 20 to 50 measurements per second of the brightness of the star. And then we compare that brightness of the star to how bright the star is when it's outside of the rings. And we use the ratio of those two to measure the transmission through the rings. And conventionally, we write that transmission as e to the minus tau, where tau is the optical depth. So tau goes from zero, meaning the rings are completely transparent, the transmission through them is one, to tau equals infinity in principle. But in the C ring, the maximum optical depths we see are about 0.7. So that means about e to the minus 0.7, or about one half of the light makes it through the ring. So then we, for every measurement of the star's brightness, we plot a dot on one of these curves. So this profile shows you the optical depth, or basically one over the transmission of the rings. And what you see is an undulating pattern with a wavelength of about 1,000 kilometers. And then it's interrupted by these more opaque regions in the outer part of the profile. We refer to these as plateaus because they look kind of like plateaus if you imagine this was a sort of a topographic profile. But what we care about here is on a much smaller scale. So the bottom panel shows a region that's about 400 kilometers wide from the middle panel blown up. So now you see that just goes from about 81,900 to 82,300. And when you blow it up, you see what look like just spikes in the middle panel actually turn out to be little series of spikes. And if you blow them up even more, so the little inset in the bottom panel shows the middle one of those series of spikes blown up at an even larger scale. And now you can see that this is actually a wave-like feature. These series of spikes are regularly spaced. They get closer together as you go inwards. This is a characteristic of a wave propagating in the rings. And what we're going to be talking about for the rest of this talk are what we've learned from looking at these waves in the C-ring. But let me back off for context a bit, because where we see the waves more commonly is actually in the A-ring. So if you go to slide 5, you'll see the same picture of the rings at the top. But now below that, you'll see a zoomed-in Cassini image of a little piece in the outer sort of 20% of the A-ring, the region between the Encke gap and the edge of the ring. And this is actually an image in transmitted light. So the spacecraft was on the opposite side of the rings to the sun when it took this image. So the blacker parts in the image are where the rings are optically thicker and less light goes through. So this is rather analogous to the occultation profile I just showed you before, but this one is actually a real image. And you in fact see three nice prominent wave trains here in the A-ring, and the strongest one is the one on the left, and then there's two weaker ones in the middle and to the right edge. And it turns out that each of these wave trains, of which there are many dozens in the A-ring, but these are just three examples, each of them are indeed waves in the rings, and they're driven by the various small and medium-sized satellites of Saturn that orbit outside the rings. And they're not just driven at any location. They're driven at a location which we refer to as an orbital resonance. And that just means a place in the rings where the orbital periods of the ring particles are a simple rational fraction or multiple of the orbital period of the satellite. Now, remember that the rings themselves are made up of billions and billions of little individual icy grains up to the size of small cars or buses, maybe, but individual blocks of ice, all traveling on pretty much circular orbits around the center of the planet. So that big strong wave at the left occurs at a point in the rings where the orbital period of ring particles is 5/6 of the orbital period of Janus, which is one of the small satellites about 14,000 kilometers outside the ring edge. The other two, the one in the middle, turns out to be at the location where the orbital period is 12/13 of Pandora's orbital period. Pandora is a somewhat smaller moon, a little closer to the rings. It's actually one of the F-ring's Shepherd moons. And the outer one is caused by the other F-ring Shepherd, Prometheus, which is even closer to the rings. So in this case, the ring particle orbital period is 18/19 of Prometheus's period. So you can see that the closer the ring particle gets to the satellite, the closer the two numbers in this ratio become. But for each such simple ratio that you can write down, there is a resonance in the rings, and that resonance is capable of generating waves in the rings. And these waves are very analogous to the ones we've seen in the C-ring, which we think are due to the planet. But I want to spend a few minutes explaining a bit more to you how these resonances with satellites produce waves in the rings, because the ones produced by Saturn oscillations are basically analogous, although they're a little less obvious than the satellite waves. So let me go to the next slide then, which is number 6. It's labeled What Happens at a Resonance. And this is the first of a series of, it's not actually a movie, it's a series of sort of cartoon frames to try to illustrate what's going on. So this really boils things down to, it's really basic essentials of the resonance. So the orange circle in the middle is the planet, Saturn. The gray band around it is a cartoon of the rings. And then the blue circle within that is an example of a ring particle. And the dash curve shows the orbit that the ring particle is following. And in this case, we're assuming that the ring particle has an orbital period of 4 days, just to make things life simple. In reality, the orbital periods are more like half a day, but we'll assume 4 days here. And there's a satellite or a moon outside the rings that has a period of 8 days. So in this case, we're dealing with what's referred to as a 1-to-2, or sometimes a 2-to-1 resonance. The ratio of the orbital periods is 4-to-8 or 1-to-2. And you can see there's at the bottom left of the plot, there's a label that says the time step. So what we're going to do is step through the motion of the ring particle and the moon at intervals of 1 day. So this is at T minus 1 day. If we go to the next page, we see T equals 0 days. And this is chosen to be the time when the ring particle is closest to the moon. The ring particle is at the same orbital longitude that the moon is. And there's a little blue arrow there that indicates that this is the point in its orbit where the ring particle will feel the greatest gravitational tug from the moon because it's closest to it. The other thing to note here is we've now put the ring particle on a slightly eccentric orbit. So its actual orbit, which is the white solid line, you can see it changes in radius as it goes around the planet. And in fact, the particle has been put at what's referred to as the pericenter of its orbit, the point in the orbit that's closest to the planet. So now as we track on to the next slide, to number eight here. Okay, so now we're at T equals plus 1 day. So remember, the orbital period of the ring particle is 4 days, so we've gone around one quarter of an orbit for the ring particle, so it's moved from the 3 o'clock position to the 6 o'clock position. But the moon, since it has an 8 day period, has only moved around 1/8 of its orbit, so they're moving apart. And if we go to slide 9, now at T equals 2 days, the ring particle has now completed 1/2 of an orbit, so it's round at the 9 o'clock position. But notice also that it's moved from the pericenter, the closest point on its orbit, to the apocenter. It's now as far from the planet as it gets on its orbit. But notice that the moon, though, is now only at the 6 o'clock position. So the moon is far from the satellite, even though the satellite is at its greatest distance from the planet. The ring particle is its greatest distance from the planet. It's not very close to the moon. And then if we continue on to the next one, T equals 3 days, the ring particle has moved around to the midnight position. The moon has moved a bit further. And then finally, if we go to slide 11, we've completed one orbit. The ring particle, it's 4 days. T equals 4 days. So the ring particle has gone around once. It's come back to pericenter. But notice that the moon, has only moved half an orbit because its period is 8 days. So it's now on the other side of Saturn from the ring particle. So then if you just step through the next 4 pictures, which we don't have to describe, you can see the pattern that continues. At 5 days, the moon continues on its first orbit. The ring particle begins its second orbit. Slide 13, the ring particle has gotten back to apoaps. It's got back to its most distant point from the planet. But as in the previous case, at 2 days, you notice when the ring particle is at apoaps, the moon is 90 degrees away. In this case, the moon is up at the 12 o'clock position rather than the 6 o'clock position. But again, it's 90 degrees away. And then we move on to number 15. And the ring particle has completed 1 3/4 orbits. And you can see it's beginning to catch up to the moon again. And then by the time we get to T equals 8 days, lo and behold, the ring particle has lapped the moon. It's basically gone around 2 complete orbits while the moon has finished 1 orbit. But notice that the ring particle has come back to periaps again. So it's come back to where it feels a strong tug from the moon, but it's at the same location in its orbit the first time it felt such a tug, which is at periaps. And that really is the essence of what we mean by a resonance. When you have this rational multiple, like 2-to-1 between the periods, it means that whenever the ring particle comes closest to the moon, which is when it really feels the gravity from the moon, it turns out to be in the same location in its orbit. And it turns out the stable location is the way it's drawn here. In other words, when the moon is at pericenter, when it's closest to the moon. So a quick stop for questions again. Does this make sense? It's about to get a little bit more complicated from here on. Okay. So that shows what happens for one moon, one ring particle being traced around. But in reality, the rings are composed of lots and lots of particles. And in particular, they're spread all the way around the ring. So at any given time, there are ring particles at all sorts of different longitudes in the ring relative to the moon. And if we look at slide 16, the blue particle is the one that's marked in blue with a blue dot, is the same particle that we've been tracing in the previous model. And it's in the same position. It's at pericenter in its orbit, and it's lined up with the moon. On the other hand, the red particle is a particle that's half in orbit in front of the blue particle. So it's on the say this carefully. It's one orbit ahead of the blue particle. So it is also at periapse, but it's 180 degrees away from the moon when it's at periapse. And remember that our original particle was at periapse when it was lined up with the moon and when it was 180 degrees away from the moon. Conversely, the yellow and the green particles are just half an orbit ahead or behind of the blue particle, so they are currently at the apoapse of their orbits rather than the periapse, so they're at their greatest distance from the planet. But as we saw before in the previous little sequence, whenever these particles are at their apoapses, they happen to be 90 degrees away in longitude from where the moon is. So the net result, if you imagined putting in many, many particles, not just the four particles that are shown here, you wind up, if you trace a line connecting all these particles, it basically forms an elliptical curve. So if you look a bit more closely at this diagram, you will now see that our gray ring is not circular anymore. Its inner edge is circular, but its outer edge is elliptical. And the short dimension of the ellipse is lined up with the moon. It goes through the red-blue particles. The long edge of the ellipse is 90 degrees from the moon, lined up with the yellow and green particles. So the effect of the moon on the ring is to produce a perturbation in the ring, so the ring has an elliptical shape. For this particular resonance, it's a regular ellipse with two maxima and two minima. And the important thing is that as time goes on, so if you go to slide 17, as the ring particles move on their individual orbits, their phasing is such that this whole elliptical pattern just rotates in space, but it rotates at the same rate that the moon rotates. So as the moon moves around 90 degrees, and if we go to slide 18, the moon has moved another 90 degrees, the pattern has moved around again. In this case, the moon has now gone around half an orbit. So remember that the ring particles have done a whole orbit, so the blue particle is back in the sort of 1:30 o'clock position it was in the first slide, whereas in the slide before, you might have noticed that the blue particle was in a different location, down at the 7:30 o'clock position. So as time goes on, the individual particles move around their orbits the same as they did before, but all in the appropriate phasing, so some of them are near pericenter, some of them are near apocenter. But the pattern they make as a whole is an elliptical shape pattern that rotates around and tracks the motion of the moon. So you can see that continued in slide 18 and slide 19. The whole pattern remains basically stationary, but it's rotating with the moon. So that's what happens to the particles that are located at one particular distance from the planet, along what was the edge of what would have been initially a circular ring before we put the moon in. So the moon distorts that circular ring into an elliptical ring. And this is a 2-to-1 resonance, but if we had looked at, say, a 3-to-2 resonance, where the ratio of orbital periods was 2-to-3, we would produce not an ellipse, but a kind of a curve that has 3 maxima and 3 minima. So it's not the ellipse that's important, it's the fact that it's a non-circular curve that has a certain number of maxima and minima. So if we look at slide 20, which is basically the end of our tutorial here, you can now see the effect. So again, down at the bottom left, or at the left-hand side, we have a snippet of that photograph of the ring showing the wave at the 5-to-6 resonance. And on the right, we have a cartoon showing what the shapes. Now, we're not showing individual ring orbits anymore. We're just showing the shapes of disturbed rings. So rings that started out circular, but they've now been distorted by the resonance. So now the white circle in the middle is again the planet. The white dot over to the right is the location of the moon. And each of the solid lines here, while it may look circular at first glance, in fact is not circular. And since this is a 5 to 6 resonance, this resonance produces a distortion in the ring that has 6 minima and 6 maxima as you go around. So the minima and maxima are separated by 30 degrees. There's 12 of them around the circle, right? And so basically you produce a sort of a hexagon, say, pattern, or a pattern with hexagonal symmetry. But there's one final twist. You can see there's a dashed curve drawn here near the inner edge of this ring. The dashed curve is supposed to indicate the actual resonant location. That's the point in the rings where the orbital period of the ring particle is exactly 5/6 of Janus's orbital period. Now, if you go a little bit further out in the ring, out to larger radii, Kepler's law tells us that the orbital period gets longer as the radius of an orbit increases. So as you move outwards, the orbital periods don't quite match 5/6 of Janus anymore. They're longer. So the main distortions produced by the moon, or the produced by the resonance with the moon, happen right near the dashed curve. That's the point where ring particles keep feeling a tug every time they're, say, at pericenter in their orbit. And if the ring particles didn't interact with one another, that would be the end of the story. You would just have a local hexagonal-shaped distortion in the ring within a few kilometers of where the resonant location was. And it wouldn't be very spectacular. You'd have to look very close to see this. But the ring particles do interact with one another. They have mass. Their particles are centimeters up to tens of meters in size. They're made of more or less solid ice, or at least compacted snow. So they have non-trivial gravitational influence on one another because they're close together, and they're all traveling around at almost the same speed. So even very small gravitational forces are appreciable. They can modify the orbits of the ring particles. So that phenomenon that we refer to as self-gravity, meaning the gravity felt by one ring particle due to another, as opposed to the much larger gravity that's keeping them all in orbit around the center of Saturn. But that self-gravity modifies their orbits, and in fact, if you take that region around the resonance where the dash curve is and you impose this hexagonal-shaped distortion that's moving around at the same speed as the moon, what that does is drive a wave in the ring. And that wave in the ring is there because the ring particles interact by self-gravity. So we have waves that propagate on the surface of a lake, for example, and those waves propagate because there's a restoring force. If you displace the water away from the surface of the lake, it comes back down. For very large waves, like tsunamis, that restoring force is gravity. For small waves, like the ones you get behind a powerboat on a lake, or little ripples if you throw a pebble in the pond, the restoring force is more the surface tension at the surface of the water that tends to flatten out the ripples. So in this case, it's more like the tsunami. The restoring force is the gravity within the ring. And the net result is that that hexagonal pattern produces a six-sided spiral pattern that rotates outwards. It all rotates around with the same period as the moon, but it basically slowly propagates outwards through the rings. And you can see that spiral pattern here, but it's actually not being drawn on. It's just a matter of where the individual hexagonal patterns, they're shifted in phase, and where several lines get close together, your eye sort of blurs that together and sees part of the spiral. But all the spiral is the net effect of all of these disturbed streamlines or paths that the ring particles follow, and they've all been rotated a little bit relative to the one inside. And that rotation reflects the fact that the orbital period is slower as you move outwards in the ring. So ring particles at different locations tend to move at different rates. So if you disturb them, they then gradually fall behind the ring particles that are further in. So the net result is what's called a trailing spiral pattern. And if you count them up and your eyes don't cross in the process, you will find that there's 6 arms in this particular spiral. And the orbital direction, like in the previous cartoons, is clockwise, So this is a trailing spiral. As you go in the direction opposite the orbital motion, the spiral moves outwards. And that, in fact, is exactly what you're seeing in the left-hand picture. So this pattern of what look like concentric dark rings are, in fact, the successive arms of this six-sided spiral. But they're wrapped much more tightly than the cartoon shows. So when you take a little snapshot of a piece of the rings, like Cassini did here, you see what looks like just a set of concentric patterns. But you notice they're getting closer and closer together as you go outwards in the ring or to the upper right. And that reflects the fact that as you go around this spiral, as the spiral moves away from the resonance, it gets more and more tightly wrapped. So the successive arms get closer and closer together. So if you could look at this picture on the lower left and count out from the bottom, if you counted out six of those black lines, you would have come back to the same actual spiral arm that you see in the first one. So there's six arms wrapped around together here. So, make sense so far?
Makes sense to me.
All right. So, that's kind of a long introduction, but basically that's the essence of what's going on here. So let's go back to the C-ring, look at the waves we have there, and see how similar they are to the satellite waves. So slide 21 takes us back to the C-ring, the same plot we looked at before, reminding you of the optical depth profile and the fact that we see these wave-like things, or what I were asserting were wave-like things, these little packets of oscillations. And now, like the satellite waves we were just looking at in the A-ring, you can see that these waves, the successive peaks get closer together. But in this case, they get closer together going inwards towards the planet rather than outwards. And from the mechanics of how these waves are driven, what we know, that's telling us that these waves are being driven by something which is rotating around or orbiting faster than the ring particles are. Remember when we dealt with the satellite, the waves in the A ring due to satellites, they were driven by satellites that orbit outside the rings. So the satellites are orbiting more slowly than the ring particles. And that produces a wave that propagates outwards. When we see these waves propagating inwards, that's a giveaway that we're looking at a forcing due to something that is rotating faster than the ring particles themselves. So that's one clue. Clue number two is on slide 22. Not all of our occultations, but some of our occultations, the star moves behind the ring in such a way that we cross a given radius in the ring twice. Basically, the star moves, slices across what we refer to as one ansa of the rings or one corner of the rings, and the star goes in behind the rings, reaches a certain minimum radius, and then comes back out again. So this is from one particular occultation. We're looking at four different waves here, and the radius of the waves is written in the upper right corner. So two of them are around 82,000 kilometers, and the other ones are at 84 and 87,000 kilometers. And in each panel, the white and the purple curve show you two traces from the same occultation. So these are measurements done only an hour or two apart, but at two different longitudes in the rings as the star went in and out. And you see basically the same pattern. You see the same wavelength of the oscillations, but you notice that the phase is different. The purple curve is not in phase with the white curve, and the difference in phase is different for different waves. The one in the lower left, for example, the purple curve is almost exactly 180 degrees out of phase with the white curve. The purple peaks basically line up with the minima in the white curve. Whereas in the top left panel, the phase difference is only about a third of a cycle, or about 120 degrees. The purple peaks are about one-third of the way between two white peaks. So, and we know the radius scale on these plots accurate to better than a kilometer. So this is not due to us making errors in plotting the locations. We are confident that the actual peaks are in different locations in what we call the ingress and the egress, the two halves of the occultation. So that suggests to us that we're not looking at really concentric features in the rings, even though they might look like that to the naked eye. They are, in fact, spiral patterns. They're patterns in which the radius of the peaks varies as you go around in longitude. So these two bits of evidence, the fact that we see these wave-like structures, in this case with the wavelength decreasing inwards, and we see that they're spiral-shaped, we see the ingress and egress don't line up, This strongly suggested to us that these wave patterns are analogous to the what we call density waves, those waves that we've seen in the A-ring due to satellites. But we know that there aren't any satellites of Saturn that have orbital periods less than periods in the A-ring, in the C-ring. In the C-ring, the orbital periods of ring particles are only about 7 hours, and we know there aren't any satellites with orbital periods less than 7 hours. So what could be causing this? And the answer is on slide 23. Now, you might want to say something here, Sean. So this is a slide that actually is a movie, which I think is available as a separate file.
Yes, there's a separate file. It's an animated GIF that's available on the CHARM website. So that can be downloaded right now.
So I'll tell you what's in the picture, but it makes more sense if you can look at the movie version.
So perhaps people can play the movie while you speak to it.
Okay. So this shows an example of three different kind of waves. And this is now going back to what we talked about at the very beginning, which is that Saturn could oscillate. It could ring like a bell and with many different modes. And this shows three of the lowest order or simplest modes that a planet like Saturn could oscillate in. And the first column is labeled L equals M equals 2. So this is a mode that if you looked around the equator, there would be two minima and two maxima, a bit like an ellipse. It would be an ellipse in cross-section if you look down on the equator. The second column shows an L equals M equals 3. So this is a mode that has three minima and three maxima if you were to look down on the equator. And that little cuspy thing at the top is the pole. And if you can see the movie version, you can see that it's rotating around that point. And the column on the right, the third one, shows the L equals M equals 4 mode. So this particular mode has 4 peak, 4 maxima, and 4 minima as you go around the equator. And all of these modes don't have any variations with latitude. In other words, you go from the North Pole to the South Pole. The North and South Poles are nodes. They're places where the displacement is zero, and the displacement is a maximum at the equator, but in between it just varies smoothly. And the reason there are three rows here, which you can see more in the movie case, is that these modes don't actually sit still. They rotate in the planet. And there's two kinds of these modes. There are so-called retrograde ones, which are ones that rotate in the opposite direction to the direction the planet rotates. Now, they rotate, they go faster than the planet with periods of 2 or 3 hours, whereas Saturn rotates with about a 10-hour period. So there are both prograde and retrograde modes. In other words, modes that go in the same direction the planet rotates and modes that go in the opposite direction. And in fact, you can combine the two. If both exist, you can have a standing wave, which just shows the top rows. So these are all modes that the planet can oscillate in. The ones that we care about are the bottom row, the prograde modes, because those are the ones that move in the same direction as the ring particles orbit. And they can act rather like satellites in the sense that they can produce resonances in the rings. Now, if we go on to the next slide, and I'm going to go back to my other mode so that I can read the number, number 24. So this compares, on the left, what we talked about before, resonances in the rings due to an external moon. And we talked about the case of a moon to orbit, moon orbit to ring particle ratio 1 to 2 in the example we looked at before. But actually that number could be any value m, so in general it could be m over m plus 1. The analogous thing on the right is that you have these various modes that the planet can oscillate in, and this particular cartoon shows the L equals m equals 2 case where there's 2 maxima and 2 minima around the planet. And that can rotate around, and it can rotate faster than the ring particle's orbit, so it can produce the right kind of resonance. This particular cartoon is drawn for a 3 to 2 period ratio. So in other words, the Saturn is the mode in Saturn is rotating at a rate that's three halves the rate. Sorry,
but when you look at it, you can see.
Pardon me, it appears that someone's got an open mic. If you have a question, please let us know. But otherwise, please use star 6 to mute.
You're photographs where you're spinning something and a brand going.
I'm sorry, was that a question from someone in the audience?
Can you say again, please? Okay, I couldn't quite catch that, so we'll go on for the moment. So this picture actually is a movie embedded, so if any of you are looking at the PowerPoint version, you can actually see this as a movie as well, but if not, don't worry about it. You go ahead, you'll actually see the planet rotate, or the mode on the planet rotating, and the ring particle moving around, and if your eyes are good enough and you can count things, you'll find that the mode on the planet is going around three times for every two orbits of the ring particle. But except for the fact that the mode is moving faster than the ring particle, it's almost exactly the same as what we talked about before with the satellite case. So if we go on to slide 25, this just shows three still frames to just compare these or make this point again. So the top row of three pictures shows again an example of resonances with a satellite. And for a single moon, for each ratio of integers you can think of, so m equals 2 is the case of 2 to 1, or 1 to 2. M equals 3 is the case of 2 to 3, period ratio. M equals 4 is the case of 3 to 4. So for each value of m, there is a different resonance. There's a different location in the rings where the orbital period is the appropriate fractional multiple of the moon's period. So a single moon can make multiple waves in the rings because there are multiple resonant locations, but all of those patterns rotate around the planet at the same rate that the moon does. They all do the same thing that we saw in the cartoons before. The difference with the planet modes that are shown in the bottom is that any given oscillation mode in the planet has a particular shape. So it's either an m equals 2 shape with two maxima, or an m equals 3 or an m equals 4 shape. So that means it's just a single resonance. But unlike the moon case, the different patterns rotate around the planet at different speeds because the different modes oscillate inside the planet at different speeds. So one moon can make multiple resonances and therefore multiple waves. One oscillation mode in the planet only makes one wave or one resonance, but different oscillation modes will generate oscillations with different frequencies and therefore resonances at different places. So you can again get multiple waves at different locations if you're dealing with oscillation modes that are m equals 2, m equals 3, m equals 4. And those, in fact, exactly are the ones that we see in the planet or in the rings.
Okay.
So slide 26 reminds us where some of these modes are. Oh, I hear something in the background here, but maybe just an unmuted mic. Did you hear a question, Sean, or?
I did, and I think there's another unmuted mic. I think you're correct.
Okay. So, in fact, these waves were first looked at in Voyager data taken back in 1980, and Mark Marley and Carolyn Porco wrote a paper in 1993 suggesting that maybe these waves might be due to exactly these internal oscillation modes in Saturn that we're talking about here. But they only had very limited data from Voyager, so they weren't able to measure the rate at which these waves rotated or what the M value was. So they really couldn't test the theory. But what they did do was calculate roughly what the frequencies of oscillation inside the planet should be. And they found that M equals 2 modes should have frequencies that ought to produce resonances where the red triangle is, so in the sort of range from 85 to 88,000 kilometers. And in fact, two of the waves happened to fall in that range. They found that an M equals 3 oscillation in the planet, and they could not calculate the exact frequency because there are uncertainties in our internal models of Saturn. But they figured that the resonances should fall somewhere in the region indicated by the yellow triangle, and that overlaps another three of these waves. And then the M equals 4 modes in the planet should cover the region shown by the blue triangle between about 80 and 82,000. That overlaps the M equals 3 and also spans a couple of modes. So they suggested that M equals 2, 3, and 4 modes in the planet could have resonances at about the right place to explain the data. So if we looked at slide 27, we come back to the Cassini data and how we've been able to verify this theory. So this again shows one of the waves, and again the white and purple curves show an ingress and egress, two measurements that are done a few hours apart. We can measure the phase difference between these. In other words, in this particular case, this was the case where the purple curve is almost halfway between the white peak, so the phase difference is almost 180 degrees. And over on the right, it schematically shows the locations of the ingress and egress tracks across the ring that the stellar occultation took. And for different modes, different numbers of spiral arms, we can calculate what the phase difference ought to be for those two. So I'm going to, I think, skip over the next slide because it would take another 15 minutes to explain, perhaps. But for those of the real geeks in the audience, this is the way we actually do this. It's done by applying a wavelet transform to the data, which lets us measure the wavelengths and the phases and amplitudes of wavelengths present in an oscillation. But maybe I'll ask you for the time being to take my word for that, and we can talk about this later if some people would like to see how this actually works. Go ahead to slide 29. And this actually shows, again, from an example of white and purple, again, show an ingress and egress occultation track. And the wavelet lets you measure the power or the strength of the oscillation as a function of radius. So the middle panel shows the strength of the oscillation, where it's strongest. And you can see it's strongest in the middle of the plot at around 84,635 to 640 kilometers. And both the white and purple curves peak at about the same place. The important thing is the bottom plot, and this shows the phase difference between the two curves. And that line shows the measured phase difference. And at the left and right edge of the plot, the wave is almost non-existent, so basically you just get noise and you get a mess. But near the middle of the plot, you can see that the white line converges on a value that's around about 200 degrees, and the number here says that the mean value was 195 degrees. So that's not bad, because we can look at this plot and see that the phase difference is roughly 180, because the white curve is, white peaks are sort of halfway between the purple peaks. So this is how we go about measuring the phase difference between a pair of occultations. And then if you go to slide 30, you'll see exactly the same thing, but now it's for a different wave. This is one at 82,000 kilometers. In this case, you can see the phase difference is more like 120 or 240 rather than 360, and indeed, again, the two waves peak at about the same radius, but the bottom panel now shows that the phase difference between the two waves is in fact 251 degrees, or that's 360 minus 110 degrees. So the phase difference is about what you'd guess by eye looking at the plots.
So Phil, I'm sorry, I have a question of clarification. The dashed lines, what do those represent?
The vertical dashed lines?
Yes, those ones.
Yeah, so the vertical ones are, as you can see, if you go away from the center of the plot where the wave gets weaker, the phase gets less well-defined. And in fact, even if you go 5 kilometers away, the phase can shift by 30 or 40 degrees. So to be conservative in the analysis, we only used the part of the data where the wave amplitude was largest. So in reality, we only used the part of the phase between the two dashed lines. So that numerical value that says 251 there, that's the average of that phase curve between the two dashed lines. And we discarded everything outside of that where the signal-to-noise was poorer. Okay?
Okay, thanks.
And the dotted curve, in fact, is that mean value of the phase. So for every pair of occultations of a particular wave, you can do this. You can measure the phase difference. So the slide 31 shows actually that same pair of profiles again for the wave at 82,650 kilometers. And you can measure the phase difference, and it's written on the plot. Oh, sorry, it's a different pair. It's the same wave. It's a different data set, different pair of occultations. So in this case, the measured phase difference is written on the plot. It's about 150 degrees, just a bit off 180. And then for each possible mode, and we don't know which mode we're looking at that's oscillating inside the planet, but we know that it's either the M equals 2 or the M equals 3 or the M equals 4 or the M equals 5. There's just a finite set of possible modes rather than an infinite continuum. So for each possible mode, we can calculate what the rotation period of the mode is from the mode frequency. And we know the M value, so we know how many spiral arms there are. They're just M spiral arms in each pattern. And we know the geometry of the occultation. So we can predict what the phase difference should be for that particular occultation between the ingress and egress. And we get a different prediction for each value of M. So the upper right panel with the little diamonds shows the predicted phases now for different values of M. And they're marked as negative here, but we don't need to get into that. That has to do with the fact that the wave is propagating faster than the ring particles. But notice that, for example, if M is equal to 1, the predicted phase difference is about minus 150. If it was M equals 2, it would be approximately minus 180. M equals 3 is pretty close to plus 150, which is what we observe. By the time you get to M equals 6, the predicted phase difference is about minus 10 degrees. So you can see for each value of M, you get a different predicted phase. And in this case, only one of them, M equals 3, comes close to the yellow line, which is the observed phase difference of 150. So for this one pair of occultations of one wave, it looks like M equals 3 is what fits the data, but that's not much of a check. So a good check is to go and look at that same wave in another data set. And if you go to the next slide, the top part is the same, but it adds another occultation looking at the same wave at 82,050 kilometers. And now you see the white and purple curves have a different phase relation. The phase difference here is measured at minus 110 degrees. And then if you look over at the bottom right panel, again, it shows the predicted phase differences, excuse me, for different values of M. And the pattern is different from the one above because the occultation is different, so there's a difference in time between the two tracks, for example. But again, you can see that the only one of the diamonds that falls almost on top of the yellow curve, in this case the yellow curve is at minus 110, which is what we observe for this pair, again, by magic, turns out to be M equals 3. So this is a nice confirmation that we look at the same wave in two different occultations, and we find that the phase difference in the two cuts really only works if we assume it's an M equals 3 wave. So we then went on and did this same thing, basically ad nauseum. So we looked at about something like 20 different occultations, and we looked at all possible pairs. We combined one occultation with each of the others. So we looked at something like 400 or a couple of hundred pairs of occultation tracks. And for every one of them, we determined which value of M matched. And fortunately, this process turns out to converge and work quite well. In other words, for a particular wave, you almost always find the same value of M as the one that works. So the answer turned out to be pretty unique. And phase 33 shows an example of one of these waves. This, in fact, is the one of 82,050 kilometers that we've just been looking at the examples for. That indeed turns out to be an M equals 3 wave, and it falls right within the yellow triangle, the region that Marley and Porco said M equals 3 waves should fall. So far so good. If we go to slide 34, we have other waves in the rings, though, and this shows the six best, most clearly expressed of the waves in the rings. And the one we were just looking at 82,050 kilometers is the one on the left-hand side in the middle panel. But if we look at the one in the top left panel, the one at 80,980 kilometers, if we do the same analysis for that one, and the results for that turn out to be shown in panel 35, that turns out to fit an M equals 4 wave, not an M equals 3. But that falls within the blue region, so that's in fact the predicted range for the M equals 4. So that's pretty good as well. If you go back a slide for a moment, back to slide 34, and look at the panel in the lower right, that's the wave at 87,185 kilometers. So that's the one furthest from Saturn of these six. That one, when you do the analysis and compare the phase differences, you find it only works for M equals 2. And that's shown in panel 36. So that wave is now over on the right-hand side of this plot. That's an M equals 2 wave, and again, it falls within the red triangle, so it falls within the region predicted for M equals 2 waves. So this is sort of the high point of the discussion. At this point, we have three different waves in the rings. One turns out to be M equals 2, one is M equals 3, one is M equals 4, and lo and behold, they all fall within the range of radii in the rings where Marley and Porco said that resonances with these particular oscillations should fall. So this looks perfect, and if you look at the next panel, just as a further confirmation, this shows for the M equals 3 wave, what happens is you vary the rotation speed of the wave. So we can predict the rotation speed of this wave based on the frequency of the mode in the planet. We predict that it should be 1,734.95 degrees per day. So 360 degrees per day would be one rotation per day. So this is about five times faster than this. So the predicted speed is about five rotations per day. And the minimum in this curve is an indicator of where the actual best fit pattern speed is, where the best fit rotation rate is. And that best fit speed is 1,735.01 degrees per day. So you can see that this is really works quite well. The best observed frequency is only 0.06 degrees per day different from the predicted speed. In other words, we have an accuracy of sort of one part in 10,000 between the predicted speed and the observed one. So this again confirms that we really have found what we thought would be the M equals 3 wave. But if you look at page 38, or even if you go back momentarily to page 34, remember that we had six nice strong waves in the rings, not only three. So what about the other ones? Well, it turns out that the other two that are close to 82,000 kilometers, the one at 82,000 and the one at 82,200, are also both M equals 3. And it turns out the one in the lower left, 84,635, is also an M equals 2. So slide 38 summarizes what all of these waves turn out to be. So we have a cluster of three M equals 3 waves that are around 82,000, a single M equals 4 wave at about 81,000, and two M equals 2 waves rather well separated at about 84,600 and about 87,500. And you notice that they all fall within the sort of acceptable regions. The three M equals 3 waves all fall sort of within the yellow-green triangle as the predicted range. And even the two M equals 2 waves, although they're far apart, both fall within sort of the range of more or less of the red triangle. So they're consistent with what was the uncertainty of the predictions, but the predictions were unambiguously that there should be one wave for each value of M. So we don't currently understand what's going on. There seem to be multiple waves, at least for the M equals 2 and the M equals 3 modes, at slightly different frequencies in the planet, apparently, and those slightly different planet frequencies translate into slightly different resonant radii in the rings. So this is a puzzle. And we don't have an answer to this at the moment. So where do we go from here? Well, plot 39 actually shows our familiar diagram at the bottom, our optical depth profile with the waves identified so far. And the plot at the top of right is actually from Marley and Porco's paper from 93, actually. It's mislabeled. And the value of M or L, either one, is on the vertical axis. So you can see the M equals 2, 3, 4, 5, up through 8. And on the horizontal axis is the radius in the rings. And the dotted line is the boundary between the D ring and the C ring. So this shows where they predicted the resonances to fall. And the ones that should be strongest, and all the ones that we're seeing, are the ones that are the white squares. So it's the right-hand set of points. And you can see the squares start out at 87,000 kilometers or so at M equals 2, go down to about 82,000 for M equals 3, down to a minimum radius of about 81,000 for M equals 4, and then curiously, as M or L gets larger, the resonance moves out again, so the waves are expected to move back out towards 82 or 83,000 kilometers. So this was their predicted locations of the waves. So you can see that the waves for M equals 5, 6, 7, and 8 should all fall within the same radial range on the rings as our plot at the bottom. So we went looking for weaker waves in the rings. And in fact, there are weaker ones, and some of them work. And on page, if you go to panel 40, slide 40, which is almost the same as 39, except there's a purple M equals 10 being added. That's one of those other smaller spikes, which initially was a bit too weak for us to analyze, but when we went back and looked at weaker waves, we found out that this one is also a wave driven by Saturn oscillations, but the pattern speed and M value are almost definitely 10. It's a case that's almost as strong as the others. So it's again in about the right place. If you take the Mali and Porco plot and mentally extrapolate it up to M equals 10, you can see that you'd expect the white square to be at around 82.5 to 83,000 kilometers, and in fact the M equals 10 wave is at about 83,600. So it's about the right place. But the mystery is that that's kind of the largest wave that was unidentified from before. So what happened to 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9? And the answer is we don't know. So that's a bit strange. Most physicists would expect that the amplitude of the oscillations in the planet would probably get gradually smaller as you went to higher M's. So it's reasonable that 2, 3, and 4 might be the strongest waves, but you would not expect 10 to be stronger than 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. So maybe there's something special about the M equals 10 mode, but that's basically puzzle number two. Puzzle number three is that we went looking, as I said, for weaker waves that we hadn't looked at before, and we found several more that exist within these plateau regions, this plateau at around just below 85,000 kilometers and around 86,500. And if you look at panel 41, so we're sparing you all the gory details of going through and looking at the actual waves and the phases, but suffice it to say that we found waves that live within a couple of these plateaus. We found a total of 5 of these waves, 2 of them in one plateau and 3 in the other. They all turn out to have M equals 3, so they're 3-armed spirals, but they're rotating much more slowly than the others. In fact, they're rotating more slowly than the orbital periods of the ring particles. So these look more like waves driven by an external object, like a satellite, rather than driven by a fast oscillation inside the planet. The trouble is, they rotate at speeds of about 800 to 830 degrees per day, and that's a period of around 10 hours. And as Sean can probably tell us, that's a period that's shorter than the orbital periods of any of Saturn's known satellites. In fact, if you were to conjure up a satellite with this rotation period of 10 hours, it would be orbiting in the middle of the B ring, where there are definitely not any big satellites. So these waves, although they look like satellite waves, in fact must not be driven by satellites. But as some of you may know already who are sort of versed in Saturn things, 810 to 840 degrees per day is a familiar number. It's the rotation rate of the planet itself. Or more correctly, it's the rotation rate of clouds that we observe in the atmosphere of the planet, and also the rotation rate of magnetic signatures that we see, actually radiation emissions from the planet, radio waves from the planet, which we think originate in the magnetosphere, the region around the planet that's governed by the planet's magnetic field. So on slide 41 here, I've showed where the M equals 3 waves are. They're in those two plateaus, and the panel at the top right shows the rotation period. The bottom half of that panel shows the measured rotation rate for clouds in Saturn's atmosphere at different latitudes. And near the equator, they're fastest, getting up to about 840 degrees per day. At mid-latitudes, they're slower, averaging about 820. But you can see there's, in fact, a big range from about 810 to 830 degrees per day. The clouds at different latitudes on Saturn rotate at different rates. The top half of that panel has two curves labeled northern SKR and southern SKR, and those are the rotation periods inferred from the radio emissions that Cassini, the RPWS instrument on Cassini, measures coming directly from Saturn itself or from its environs. These are low-frequency radio waves, and they're pulsed a little bit like a lighthouse, although not quite so regular as a lighthouse. But like a lighthouse, you can measure the period with which these pulses of radio waves arrive at the spacecraft, and figure out the rotation rate of the lighthouse. And it turns out that those periods are different in the northern and southern hemisphere, so there are two curves, and they have drifted over time. So this plot shows the drift from 2004, when Cassini arrived at Saturn, up to 2012, where we are now. And the white curves indicate the radio emissions. The purple curves indicate, I think that's actually measured from the magnetic field, and those are direct inferences of what the rate at which the magnetic field may be rotating in the northern and southern hemispheres. So any self-respecting planet should have a given fixed rotation rate for its magnetic field, and it shouldn't matter whether you're looking at the northern or the southern hemisphere. So Saturn is misbehaving in this way, and this has also been a major mystery concerning the interior of the planet. But you can see the range of these periods measured for the magnetic field go from 800 to 820 degrees per day, and the white dotted the vertical dotted lines on that plot show the pattern speeds that we measured for these five M equals 3 waves in Saturn. So two of them are around 833 degrees per day, which sort of match the equatorial wind speeds on Saturn. The other three are at around 810 degrees per day and could either match the lowest wind speeds in the atmosphere, or they could pretty much match the middle of the SKR and magnetic field periods. So we think these particular five waves are driven not by an oscillation in the planet, but by some fixed gravitational disturbance in the planet that's rotating around at periods similar to what we know the rotation period to be. The strange thing is that what we're looking at in the rings is undoubtedly driven by gravity coming from deep inside the planet. So it suggests that these surface wind speeds or magnetospheric rotation periods in fact have counterparts deep in the interior of the planet, maybe not in the very core of the planet, but at least well below the surface, enough to disturb the gravity of the planet so that that gravity produces a measurable signature in the rings. So that's, if you like, the third mystery of what's going on. Why do we see an interior signature of Saturn's rotation? Does it indicate there's some gravity anomalies inside the planet? And it looks like if there are, these gravity anomalies move at different speeds, maybe at least five different speeds, because we see these five different waves. So I think I will skip slide 43 because we've gone on for a little bit and go to the summary on slide 44 so that we can answer some questions. And just to highlight some of the main things that we've seen here, and that is we do see waves in the C-ring. Those waves are indicative of being forced by something that's rotating around faster than the C-ring itself. And the only plausible source are oscillations rotating inside the planet. But although we see the waves at approximately the right locations in the rings to be resonances with those oscillations, following Mali and Poco's predictions from 20 years ago, we see several of these modes split. We see three M equals three modes and two M equals two modes, so that we don't understand. We see an M equals 10 mode as reasonably strong, whereas we don't see M equals 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. And then we also see these internal, what we think are variations in density inside the planet, rotating at different rates, similar to the rotation rate of the clouds that are producing these M equals 3 waves. But all of these offer, once we really understand what's going on here, some very different and potentially quite powerful ways of learning about the interior structure of the planet. Ultimately, if you could predict the resonant frequencies of these modes, and as you can see, we've measured them to about one part in 10,000, if you could predict them, then that would be very sensitive to your detailed models of the density variations inside the planet. And if we could explain why the modes are split, that might tell us something about distinct layers, for example, in the planet. Maybe there's a rocky, icy core that is distinct from the outer hydrogen envelope, and the boundary between those two could be what's leading to the splitting that we're seeing in the modes. And then finally, these modes that seem to be rotating with the planet give us a strong hint that this differential rotation, these different wind speeds we see at the surface of the planet may not just be skin deep, they may extend significantly into the interior of the planet. And that's something that has not really been suspected strongly before. As I said at the bottom, stay tuned for the future. There's still a lot to be learned about these modes, and especially a lot to be figured out about Saturn once we decide how we can do it.
Okay, so I'd like to thank Dr. Nicholson for a really, really interesting talk. And I'd like to kick off the question period, if I could, with a couple of questions for you, Phil. This is sort of related here. How can we relate what you're seeing to gravity coefficients? Is there any way to translate these directly into coefficients, such as what will be measured by RSS at the very end of the mission, or maybe another way to ask it, is there any way that this work can inform the gravity measurements that will be made by the radio science system at the end of the mission?
I think the best answer to that might be to look at what people have been able to do for the Earth and for the Sun, where people have been looking at these kind of internal oscillations for decades. So they understand in fairly much detail now exactly which modes they're looking at and where they come from. In both cases, we can make quite detailed density profiles for the interior of the Earth and for the interior of the Sun. In other words, we can figure out what the density is as a function of radius inside the planet. Now, for the Earth, it turns out we already sort of knew that from classical seismology. But starting in the 1960s, when these same kind of oscillations were detected inside the Earth, within a decade or so, people were able to basically reconstruct the density profile of the Earth, independent of what had been learned from seismology, just by matching these frequencies. It's that same density profile that's responsible for the gravity coefficients, the J2, the J4, the J6, that you can measure with an orbiting spacecraft outside the planet, in which Cassini will measure on its final orbits. So while I'd say while we won't determine directly the gravity coefficients from this, the oscillation frequencies put strong constraints on the density profile, and it's the same density profile that determines the gravity coefficient. So they're both measuring the same thing, which is the density profile. So there'll be a good chance to sort of check one of these kind of measurements against the other. In other words, if somebody creates a density model for Saturn that fits the gravity coefficients measured by Cassini in 3 years, they will then be able to use that model to calculate the expected frequencies of the oscillation modes and compare them to what we're seeing. And similar things were done for the Sun. So we now have quite a detailed model for the internal densities in the Sun, because we've been able to identify many of these modes. And to go one step further, what's also been learned for the Sun, which doesn't apply to the Earth, the Sun, like Saturn, has a rotation period measured in the atmosphere, which is different at different latitudes. So like Saturn, the equatorial part of the Sun rotates faster, this is done by measuring sunspots, than the higher latitudes. And it was unknown whether that differential rotation in the Sun, was that just a characteristic of the surface, or did it extend into the deep interior? We now know from helioseismology, measuring similar modes inside Saturn, that differential rotation extends about 30% of the way down into the interior of the Sun before eventually the rotation periods become the same at all latitudes. So that actually has been mapped out in some detail by looking at these seismic modes. And there's almost no other way to get a handle on that.
Okay. It sounds like there's a question from the audience. Did someone else have a question?
I'd like to know where I could get more information on this. It sounds very fascinating, and I enjoy seeing this. Where could I get hold of some more information on this? I assume there's not a textbook on this per se.
There is not yet a textbook. There are two scientific research papers that we wrote on these results. Most of it is covered in a paper that we published in the Astronomical Journal last year, 2013. And the first author is Hedman, Matthew Hedman, H-E-D-M-A-N. And I'm the second author, Phil Nicholson. So if you search for Hedman or Nicholson in 2013, and the titles of both papers are chronoseismology, so you can also search by the title of the paper, chrono with a K. Same title as the talk. So most of the stuff we talked about today is in the paper we published last year in 2013, the first six waves. The more recent stuff, including the M equals 3 waves, which we think are due to the rotation of the salt of the interior of the planet, those are in a paper published just this year, 2014, and that's in monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. It's the main British astronomical journal. And again, the authors are Hedman and Nicholson.
Okay.
And I don't think you'll have much luck with textbooks for the planets, because this is about the first time that anyone's come up with a really strong identification of these modes. But if you are interested in the wider subject of, say, seismology in the Sun, there are many textbooks that deal with the subject of helioseismology. And you can find lots of good stuff if you just Google that. Wikipedia has a really excellent article on helioseismology, and if you want to understand this basic phenomenon a bit more, I'd really recommend that as a place to start. That's what I looked at when I needed to remind myself how this stuff worked, and it's a really good sort of semi-technical article with lots of diagrams and things. But that's for the Sun. I don't think you'll find much on the planets.
Okay, well, I'll start there then and see. I would just like to say I found this particular topic very, very interesting. My first degree is in music, and it's nice to see some of the overlap here in talking about the harmonics and the fundamentals, and I those diagrams showing the ring interactions with the moons. That's the kind of thing I want to get over to other people, and it's hard to do just waving your hands around. So I appreciate the nice diagrams.
It is. Well, that's very good. I can definitely thank my co-author, Matt Hedman, for those. He slaved over those for a long time. But I agree that there's a strong connection with music and the theory of music and frequencies and resonances. There's in fact, going way back in astronomy, the first astronomers who dealt with orbital periods and thought about these kind of things, it goes all the way back to people like Kepler. And most of those guys were pretty well steeped in musical theory. That was one of the things that are well-trained, well-rounded professional would know about at that time. And there were definitely more parallels drawn in those days than there tend to be that nowadays between music and orbital mechanics.
Well, this one certainly lends itself to it almost directly, so I
it
like
does,
that.
Yes.
Thank you.
So I wanted to get back to this question about the split oscillation modes and what that could possibly mean. is it possible, for example, that what we're seeing are, say, M equals 3 modes coming out of different depths within the planet? I mean, you could imagine that the density would be different, and therefore the rotation mode of such oscillations would be different, leading to split. Is that a possibility, Phil? What do you think?
This is the modes that rotate with the planets, right?
Yeah, so for example, you show examples of M equals 3 modes, and the frequencies are all slightly different.
Right.
Is it possible that what's happening is that they're being excited at different depths within the planet? Is that a potential explanation?
Well, hold on. Just to be clear, there are two sets of M equals 3 waves. There's the
correct.
First ones I talked about, the M equals 3 internal oscillation modes, of which we found 3 close together.
Those are the ones of which I'm thinking, yeah.
That's the one. Okay. So the one idea that's been proposed, Jim Fuller, who was a grad student at Cornell at the time, who is now a postdoc down at Caltech, suggested that if there was a solid core inside the planet, you could have like in the same way that the Earth sustains both P waves and S waves because it's a solid rather than a fluid, the outer envelope of Saturn would really only sustain compressional waves or P waves, basically sound waves. But if there were a solid interior, which many models suggest, you could also have shear waves or elastic waves propagating inside that. And the oscillations would be transmitted to some degree from the core to the envelope or the envelope to the core. So if you excited an oscillation in one, that would tend to generate a sympathetic oscillation in the other. Because one is basically a sort of pressure-driven wave, pressure slash gravity, and the other is a sort of gravity slash elastic forces, they are the same kind of wave. In other words, an M equals 3 oscillation would have different frequencies in those two regions, the fluid and the elastic region. And if by chance those two frequencies are fairly similar to one another, then the two modes could interact and you could get this kind of phenomenon. So he was able to cook up reasonably realistic models of Saturn with an elastic core that would have multiple waves. In other words, modes existing in the core primarily, modes existing in the mantle primarily, but they interacted with one another. And the net result could be two or more modes that could manifest themselves, you know, in the gravity and therefore affect the rings. The downside seemed to be that to make this work, you have to have the modes in the core, the mode in the core and the mode in the envelope have almost the same frequency. And there's no good a priori reason to believe they would have the same frequency, since they're driven by different physical processes. You know, they could well differ by a factor of two in frequency. So getting the frequencies that are so close together is kind of tricky and required some sort of fine-tuning of the model, which made it a little bit implausible. But that's about the only concrete suggestion that I've seen so far. And it does involve multiple layers in the planet.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of where I'm going, thinking about multiple layers in the planet and what this can tell you. I think it's a really rich and intriguing subject, which is why I could probably hear this for several times and get a little bit more each time you discuss it. So with that, is there anyone else out there with a question? I don't want to take up all the time. Okay, and we've gone on for a little bit longer than usual, but again, I think it's a topic worthy of an extended discussion. So if there are no more questions, I would like to thank our speaker once again and remind everyone that there will be a recording of this talk available sometime within the next couple of weeks, if not sooner, and we'll be holding our Next Charm Telecon at the end of January in 2015. So I'd like to thank our speaker again and sign off and talk to you in 3 months. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.